Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is sponsored by Gaia.com. Help find your own truth by exploring perspectives you won't find in the mainstream on some of life's biggest mysteries, whether it's grand conspiracies, breakaway societies, UFOs, ancient civilizations, or lost wisdom, as well as the paranormal, all available at your fingertips. Stream videos anywhere, from your living room or on the go, with access to over 7,000 titles. All available to you with an annual plan for $7.95 a month. If you enjoy expanding your perspective, you'll enjoy Gaia.com. G-A-I-A.com.
Howdy there, friends, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. That's right, folks, it's me, Cam Hale, and as always, the father of La Flama Blanca, sitting across the table from me, Mr. Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? I'm super thrilled about being here today. Yes, I am the father of La Flama Blanca. At least I was this weekend, right?
That's right. For those of you that aren't fans of Eastbound and Down and Kenny Powers, La Flama Blanca was his name in Season 2 when he was playing in the Latin Leagues. Well, one of Kyle's twin boys is a pitcher now in the Little League team, and that's kind of what I've stuck him with, that moniker now, is La Flama Blanca. Now, we've not let him watch Eastbound and Down.
No. In fact, I want to watch that new series he's in. What is it called? Vice Principals or something?
Yeah.
I haven't seen that yet either.
What you were telling me, though, here's what's funny, is the one twin, Caleb, he didn't want to play this season. He decided he wanted to check out. He's like, nah, I'm not really interested, Dad. Jacob said, nah, I'm going to go ahead and play.
Yeah.
And then this is three games in. And Caleb's like, man, I wished I was playing. Can I at least sit on the dugout, man? Can I come in there with y'all? Can I take BP with you guys?
I think what it is like literally he's been playing baseball since he was in T-ball. So he's never had a season off till now.
Yeah.
I think now he's realizing, you know what? It's not as much fun not playing. Like, I think he was always distracted while playing. Like, it looks like everybody's having fun over there. I wish I was doing that instead of this.
Yes.
Now that he's out there, he's like, oh, man.
I'd rather be on the field.
That's my fun playing baseball.
Some of them just
need
a little reminder.
He already wants to do it in the spring, yep. He's wanting to do it, so that's funny.
That is hilarious. Well, folks, I'm going to dive into it. For all of you ancient history buffs along with us, I found this. This comes from The Independent. It says, ancient Roman coins found buried under ruins of Japanese castle leave archaeologists baffled. That's right, baffled, folks. It says archaeologists were left baffled by this strange discovery. This is what they found. Four copper coins in the soil beneath Katsuran Castle on Okinawa Island. And they were originally thought to be a hoax. But now it's been revealed that it's not a hoax, folks. It says the designs on these coins are difficult to decipher as they may have been eroded over time. But X-ray analysis revealed several of the relics bore the image of Emperor Constantine I. Now, it says that since the excavation, on the site began in 2013, researchers have also found another six coins, which may have dated back to the Ottoman Empire in the late 17th century. Now, they go on to talk about this, that these coins appear to be much older, dating back to at least 400 A.D., according to their estimations. Now, the Board of Education in the Japanese city of Iruma announced the discovery and said that the story of how the coins came to arrive to Japan remained shadowed in doubt, that they have really no idea how they got there. They do know this, that this was a very large trading point with partnerships with China and other parts of Asia. And that's what they were talking about, this Katsuran Castle. So they believe that it could have, maybe it comes from that, this whole thing. It says, now the ruins of the castle are registered in the year 2000 on the World Heritage List as part of these Gutsurka sites here and all these province right in that area. But they really don't know. And they actually had no idea that they were tied to Europe at all until they found these coins. So it's really kind of spun them around. But it is interesting, this right here. There was an education spokesman, Matsaki Yoku, and it's what he told CNN. It is a strange and interesting find. We don't think that there is a direct link between the Roman Empire and the Katsuren Castle, but the discovery confirms how this region had trade relations with the rest of Asia, which is kind of what I was thinking about anyway. But it says that these coins will be analyzed a little further and then displayed at Aroma City Museum on Okinawa until the end of this November. But this was interesting here is, it could have easily, like coins normally. Coins could have come from, you know, how many times have you gotten change back and you look and there'll be a Canadian coin in it? So maybe that's all it was.
I agree with that, but I disagree with the guy because they always jump to that. No, they weren't here. They just must have got traded like that. Well, why is that? They just like they found Roman coins up and down the Mississippi River. No, they definitely weren't here.
Yeah.
How do you know? Maybe they were there. Maybe they were here. Maybe they were everywhere. I mean, why do we, our first conclusion
is definitely no.
Is that definitely no. That's not possible. I always.
Because it doesn't fit in our box, and that's what we say.
Right, yeah. I reject that idea. I say it is possible, and that maybe that's what happened. I just don't understand why archaeologists, they always are looking for
and it's not all of them.
No, you know, of course.
You know, broad brushing them. Yeah, there's just some of the people involved. Here's my thing.
Why couldn't they have been there?
My deal is this. There's proof. There's Roman coins there. Without saying that there's no direct link, why don't you say, obviously, there was a direct link. We have found, instead of saying there's not one or there was one, go look. This is what we know for sure. There's Roman coins there.
It's a possibility.
There is a possibility that Romans were here. That's what you have to go off of.
I like that much
instantly
better.
It's like what you're talking about. We condemn the person. You're guilty until proven innocent, instead of innocent until proven guilty.
Yeah.
And that's the way it's done with a lot of archaeological finds, is instantly it can't happen. And not like, man, if this did happen, let's look and see and prove. Let's see if there's other proof showing that it did, because we still don't know much about it, just like the things that we found in North America here. So this is just one of those things that keep your eye on. It's very interesting.
Let's Marco.
Keep
our eye on
it. Exactly.
I mean, wasn't he from Italy? Yeah, Marco Polo?
Yes.
He was in with the Mongols and stuff.
Exactly. There's lots of different ways it could have got around.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Well, sticking with Japan and the Japanese, did you see this? This is pretty interesting. A recent study by Japanese researchers added some much-needed extra data about this phenomenon of life after death.
Uh-oh.
They say that in 2014, a questionnaire was sent out to bereaved family members of cancer patients all across Japan who either died in the hospital or in these care units or at home on hospice in order to evaluate the quality of the end-of-life care they received. Now, part of that nationwide survey asked about deathbed visions. Now, in Japanese, amuke, which means literally someone visiting a dying patient to accompany them on death's journey. This is what they're talking about. They said of the 2,221 survey responses, the researchers found that amuke were reported in 463 cases, which is 21%. And of those, 351 of the families stated that the patients themselves clearly described the deathbed vision. They said while 113 noted that while the patient did not mention the vision, family members themselves witnessed the patient experiencing the phenomenon. They say of the non-deathbed vision responses, 1,392 families reported no experience occurring at all, while 365 families replied that they were unsure. Now they say of the patients who did experience deathbed visions, get this, 87% had visions of deceased persons, most often their parents, while 54% had visions of afterlife scenes. Some of the most interesting findings were that deathbed visions were significantly more likely to be observed in older patients and female patients. They also are more likely to be observed in families where they're more religious and have more religious activities, or who believe that your soul survives after your body in death. They said that the conclusion of this study shows, without a doubt, that deathbed visions are not an uncommon phenomenon. Now, like we were just talking about staying more open-minded, it seems like Japanese researchers are more open-minded to this than Western civilization. But, you know, are all those people that they surveyed making that up? I don't think so.
No.
And what's cool is it's almost always like relatives that you're seeing.
Yes.
Not just a friend of yours, like a pal you used to go fishing with. It's almost like it's your parents or grandparents or someone really close to you. And when
they're there to make the transition easier for you.
When you're slipping out, yeah, it's like they are there to help you.
Yeah.
Now, of course, there's going to be those that say, no, your body releases, creates, you know, DMT and you're having some kind of hallucination. But isn't it odd that everybody has the same hallucination?
It is funny that it all seems like, and I know some people have had darker, trips and stuff when they talk about it, but it is odd that it seems like people that have these NDEs. What's funny is if you go back and do some research into the maps and you really, when I say maps, we're talking about like the study of psychedelics, and you start looking at what Rick Strassman's done with DMT, you start digging back into this, and then you start looking at these NDEs. It's almost like what people experience on high dosages of like Rick Strassman. A lot of people will smoke DMT,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't last very long. But Rick Strassman in the spirit molecule testings and stuff was actually giving it to them in an IV form. So the trip lasted longer,
right. You went
deeper into it. A lot of the people that signed up and did that came back and told their stories independently to Rick have the exact same stories as what the people are telling when they have these NDE experiences.
Yeah.
It's almost like they both ended up going to the same place.
Even if they don't physically see their relatives, they feel warmth. Mm-hmm. They feel comfort. They feel the presence of a loved one, you know, and to me, that means that they're experiencing something. That is so cool, I think.
Well, I got you something that's strange. Okay, that's awesome. This is just strange, folks. This takes place up in Nova Scotia on Doctor's Lake there in Hebron. A couple up there found a very strange creature in the water. This comes from Journal Pioneer. You can find it pretty much anywhere, but it happened on September 29th on a Thursday. Nick Nickerson said the creature wasn't alive when his wife Joan found it near the water's edge on a private beach area that they have. And he said he's never seen anything like it. He said absolutely nothing. He says, we have lived here 14 years. I was on Lake Milo for 10 years. Now this creature, it says here, which was about 12 and a half inches long, he said, was quite firm and transparent. It seems to have, and I don't know, he says, an intestinal tract or line right through it, but it's very strange. Now, he says he's planning on contacting the Department of Natural Resources about it, but said right now he's keeping it in a bucket of water outside his house. Now, I looked at this picture, folks, and it looks like a large, and this is even says here, a jellified leech of some type is what they describe it as, and that's what it looks like.
Is it alive?
But no, it's not alive at all. Okay. It's clear, it's rough on the outside, and it has a line, a dark line about as big as your pinky finger running all the way through the center of it, that big around, like a big tube.
Right.
But there's something else when I first saw it is it almost looks like some sort of fishing lure. It almost looks like if you were to leave a plastic worm or a plastic leech or something in the water or in something for too long and maybe it's, I don't know.
You can melt them and make your own, yeah.
Yeah, but that's what it looks like is it almost looks like something that's maybe have been trash or garbage or something. That maybe it's not really alive or wasn't really alive to start with. It was just a leftover something that come out of something. Maybe it was a liner. Maybe it was filled inside of something and it come out. And they've just completely misidentified it because it looks horrible. I mean, this thing looks absolutely disgusting and that I don't want to see it. But it's one of those things, folks, keep your eyes open on the lakes. There may be some strange jelly leeches that are 12, that are a foot long. That's just what I need trying to swim around and bite a hold of me while I'm on the beach now.
Speaking of horrible and getting bit.
What?
I posted earlier this week and it's pretty interesting.
You're doing it, aren't you?
Spider bites Australian man on penis again. That's right, folks.
Round of applause, folks, for the use of the word again.
It says a 21-year-old Australian tradesman has been bitten by a venomous spider on the penis for a second time. The man was using a portable toilet on a Sydney building site on Tuesday when he suffered a repeat of the same incident 5 months ago. Jordan, who preferred not to reveal his surname, said he was bitten on pretty much the same spot by the spider. He says, I'm the most unlucky guy in the country at the moment. I was sitting on the toilet doing my business, and I just felt the sting that I felt the first time. I was like, I can't believe this is happening again. I looked down, and I've seen a few little legs come around from the rim of the commode. He said that being bitten the first time had made him wary of using portable toilets. He said, after the first time it happened, I really didn't want to use one again. Toilets got clean that day, and I thought, now's my opportunity to go use one. I had a look under both seats, and then I sat down to do my business. So the next thing you know, I bent over in pain. It says that the tradesman said he was not sure what type of spider bit him this time, and one of his colleagues took a look at him from the worksite in the northwest Sydney to Blacktown Hospital. Although many of his workmates were quick to see the lighter side of the situation, they got worried for me the first time, he said. This time, they just started making jokes before I even got in the car. So the hospital declined to discuss the matter, citing patient privacy. Now, Jordan was released from the hospital, and he said he expected to return to work soon, but was unlikely to be using the on-site toilet ever again. He said, I think I'll be holding on for dear life, to be honest. The redback spider, closely related to the black widow spider, is distinguished by a long red stripe on its abdomen. Its bite causes severe pain, sweating, and nausea. And it says, although there's no recorded cases of deaths from redback bites, none have occurred since the development of antivenom in 1956. So how terrifying is that?
Mm.
Not to get bit once, but to get bit twice.
And your buddies are like, way to go, partner.
Right, that's the best part.
Dude, that is so terrible. Look, man, I know we posted it and I read it and I was like, no, we got some comments on it. People were messaging us about it. It is funny, but it's one of those things that it's funny to laugh at now because it doesn't happen to you. But you know how terrible that must be?
Who are you talking to? I hate spiders.
Yeah, I can't believe that you even brought that up, as much as I know you hate it.
I had to.
Now you're
going to
be looking every time you go to any bathroom.
You know, I have not had anything like that happen to me, but I will tell you, I got a scare one time. I was using the bathroom at my office, and I sat down, and I used the bathroom. Everything was fine. I got done pulling up my pants, zipping everything up. And when I went to flush it, as soon as I flushed it, the biggest cockroach you've ever seen come running up out of there. That thing was literally within 2 inches of my business the whole time I was there. Never knew it.
I thought I would go back in time to pay money for that. What I immediately thought was,
dude, if that thing would have jumped on me while I was there, there's no telling what would have happened.
You'd have had to completely change your clothes, kicking and screaming and just, oh, that'd have been amazing.
Terrifying. What are we going to be talking about on today's show?
Folks, speaking of amazing. All right. For those that last week, we did the Dulce. We really got into that whole thing. Well, then we just decided to carry it on over for the elitists. So all the elitists got to hear part two of all the Dulce stuff. We brought up some more stuff about Phil Schneider. We really got deep in on it, that deal, too. Well, while we were scraping the top of that, we found some stuff on Mount Shasta. So we decided while we're in the mountain range and on that kick, I'm just going to go along with that. So after the break, we're going to dive into, and Kyle's going to start bringing up some interesting facts and some tales on Mount Shasta, folks. So stick around. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
People have always been impressed by mountains. Their epic beauty is sometimes breathtaking. People seem drawn to them, whether to write about them, to paint them, to draw them, or to photograph them, and sometimes literally climb them. People seem to love the mountains. There are numerous legends, myths, and fairy tales that include mountains, some more than others. And although there are many deeply mysterious mountains in the world, one that surely stands out as exceptional is Northern California's Mount Shasta. Ancient lost civilizations, UFOs, Bigfoot, strange creatures, anomalous people, and numerous other unexplained phenomena, Mount Shasta is just dripping with high strangeness. Lying within the southern end of the Cascade Range in Siskiyou County, California, Mount Shasta is a now dormant volcano which soars 14,179 feet, or 4,322 meters, over the surrounding forested valley, making it the second highest peak of the Cascade Range and the fifth highest mountain in all of California. Many of the first legends about the mountain are from the local Native American myths and legends. Tribes like the Akumawi, the Astuwegi, the Wintu, and the Modoc tribes all have once inhabited the area within the shadow of Mount Shasta, and all of them each considered the looming mountain to be a deeply sacred place, which was considered too powerful for humans to actually live on. The native Modocs, for instance, believed the mountain was inhabited by a great spirit, Skell, who was the spirit of the above world, and had created the mountain as a stepping stone from heaven, where he dwelled at the summit, overlooking his domain far below. Skell was said to have frequent epic battles with his enemy, Leo, the spirit of the below world and darkness, who inhabited Mount Mazama in Oregon. It was said that Skell would hurl intensely hot boulders and fiery lava at his nemesis in a fury, and that this ultimately led to the eruption of Mount Mazama, which subsequently formed the volcanic basin of Crater Lake, a place that became known to the tribes as the domain of all evil, while Mount Shasta was revered as a land of blessings. Other natives' legends swirled around the mountain for generations. It was once believed that to go up the mountain past the tree line was to invite doom, as therein was the realm of the dead, the shaman, the damned, and the mystical race of evil dwarves feared by the Wintu tribe. Mount Shasta was also said to be prowled by numerous spirits and magical beings, not all of them benevolent. And many tribes said that in more than one place on the mountain, there were portals to other realms of existence. Another interesting note is that many of the tribes here have stories which all speak of encountering a tribe of people they called the Shasta people, who were described as being shorter and darker than the Native Americans who had inhabited the region since long before their arrival. The legends say that these Shasta people were ruled by a great king who had brought a small group of his people from a mysterious land that existed far over the Western Ocean, and that they had chosen this locale because the mountain's snowy peak reminded them of their home. When the Native American tribes came, it is said that the Shasta people were eventually driven out and went off to try and seek out their original homeland, which they claimed had been submerged by the sea. Many people today point to these stories and claim that these people must have been Atlanteans who moved to the Mount Shasta area after their homes were consumed by the rising seas. But legends, myths, and strange tales of the unknown in the Mount Shasta area are certainly not confined to only Native American lore. The stories continue to this day. Perhaps the most enduring, well-known, and indeed most bizarre of these is that the mountain harbors an ancient, secret city inhabited by the descendants of the Lemurians, which are supposedly highly technological and advanced people who are said to have been the first humans on Earth and lived on a lost, sunken continent known as Lemuria. The name Lemuria was coined in the mid-19th century to denote a hypothetical sunken continent that once bridged the Indian Ocean and was so named because it was speculated that it was through this mysterious continent that lemurs had migrated from Madagascar all the way to India. The story goes that as their continent sank due to some unspecified cataclysmic event, which some circles say was the very same that sunk the more popular and well-known Atlantis, and that their civilization lay in ruin, a number of Lemurians escaped all the way to Mount Shasta to establish the city of Telos, or somewhere underneath the mountain, where they recreated their once great society and purportedly continue to live to this day. The Lemurians are typically described as being graceful, thin, ethereal beings who are very tall, up to 7 feet in height, with fair skin, long, luxurious hair, and an abnormally long neck, which they are said to decorate with collars made of beads, gold, or precious stones. The strange beings are usually clad in flowing white robes and sandals, although they are sometimes said to wear tunics or even walk about in the nude. They are said to have mastered various advanced technologies, such as atomic energy, magnetism, electronics, and some say even the ability to alter space-time itself thousands of years ago. And they are believed to possess great levitating airships, which they use for transportation. It is even claimed that they illuminate their subterranean realm with an artificial miniature sun powered by some unknown powerful energy source. The Lemurians are also purported to have a walnut-sized organ of some sort, which protrudes from their foreheads and supposedly imbues them with vast psychic powers, such as ESP, telekinesis, telepathy, and the ability to appear and disappear at will, and even the power to influence the minds of others. This legend can probably be traced back to its beginnings in a book called A Dweller on Two Planets, which was written by a Frederick S. Oliver in 1899. In the summer of 1883, a teenaged Oliver had been helping his family mark the boundaries of their mining claim, which entailed driving wooden stakes into the ground and then marking their location in a notebook. Allegedly, at some point during this arduous task, Oliver's hand began to shake and convulse uncontrollably, and started to write down things seemingly all by themselves, without him being able to control it at all himself. The boy, frightened, ran home in a panic, his hand continuing to act on its own accord, writing feverishly the entire way. And as soon as he arrived, his mother gave him more paper to write on. The initial seizure stopped shortly after, revealing the beginnings of a text. Over the next 3 years, Oliver's hand would occasionally be overcome by a mysterious force, writing several pages here and there, until finally, in 1895, he had completed an entire book which chronicled and described the existence of the secret Lemurian city and their entire history. Oliver would go on to claim that he had been chosen by the Lemurians as their secretary of sorts, and that the whole book had been telepathically channeled through him and onto the paper via automatic writing. He didn't stop there. Oliver went on so far as to claim that he had been taken astrally to the city itself and had seen it with his own eyes, describing it as being deep within the mountain and being comprised of vast number of tunnels and secret automatic doors, elegant architecture, and apartments plated with gold and carpeted with a luxurious fleecy substance. The entire city was said by Oliver to be generously decked out in crystals, gold, silver, bronze, and precious stones, the whole of which was powered by crystal energies, which were brightly illuminated and was inaccessible to outsiders without the expressed invitation of the Lemurians themselves. He also claimed that high technology was of most importance in this secret underground city, with numerous mentions of various incredible gadgets and vehicles employed by the city's residents, including a large cigar-shaped airship which hovered overhead. The book itself was quite groundbreaking and ahead of its time when it was released, making detailed mention of such high-concept notions as quantum mechanics, anti-gravity, mass transit, and zero-point energy, which he called dark side energy, all of which were extremely unique concepts at the time, which is why so many say that he was completely telling the truth. Although Oliver died in 1899 at the age of 33, his bizarre book was finally published in 1905 by his mother, Mary Elizabeth Manley Oliver. At the time of the publication of Oliver's book, it became an instant occult classic. and an openly acknowledged source for many New Age belief systems, sects, and cults. Oliver's incredible story influenced others to write more about the Lemurians. A man named Harvey Spencer Lewis also wrote a whole book on the phenomenon, which further launched the popularity of the idea of lost cities and societies lurking within the depths of Mount Shasta. From here, the accounts of this strange race of powerful beings and their highly sophisticated city of Telos really took off. In the May 22, 1932 edition of the Los Angeles Times, there appears the odd account of a Mr. Edward Lancer, who had been passing Mount Shasta in a train, when he claimed to have seen the whole southern side of the mountain blaze to life with a brilliantly bright, blinding, strange, reddish-green illumination. When he asked the train conductor what it was he had just seen, the conductor told him, "Oh, it was the Lemurians." Blown away by what the train conductor told him, he decided to investigate the strange lights further. He started out by asking locals from the area's towns about what he had seen, to which they replied that there was a mysterious community of people living within the mountain who were well known to perform rituals in the early morning and the evening, which made use of strange sources of brilliant light that could have explained his sighting. This ceremony was allegedly known as the Ceremony of Adoration to Gautama, or Gautama, being the Lemurian word for America, and the ceremony celebrating their ancestors' arrival on the continent after their own had tragically been swallowed beneath the waves. It was explained that these ceremonies used extremely bright sources of mysterious light, which were known to light up the whole side of the mountain. The locals also said that the Lemurians were known to come down from their secretive mountain realm into town from time to time. Towering, odd-looking folk, clad in their white robes and barefoot, who would buy huge amounts of sulfur, salt, and lard, which they would always pay for in gold nuggets that far exceeded the value of the merchandise itself. Lancer was stunned. He'd never heard of stories like this. All the locals seemed unaffected, like it was common knowledge for the area. When Lancer made known his intentions to go up the mountain and find these Lemurians and the source of the light he had seen, Lancer claimed that the local officials and ranchers told him that he was welcome to try, but you'll never gain access to the underground city. They were right. He tried and tried, but never found an entrance to the underground world. In the June 27, 1940 edition of the Mount Shasta Herald, William Bridge Crook wrote of a Professor Edward Larkin of the Mount Low Observatory, who claimed to have observed the mystical city at great length through his telescope on more than one occasion. Larkin had allegedly discovered the city by accident. As he was calibrating his telescope, he accidentally spied something shining anomalously on the mountain. Finding this to be a little bit peculiar, he then focused on the object and found it to be an enormous Oriental-style temple, which he describes as being a marvelous work of carved marble and onyx, rivaling in the architectural splendor of the magnificence of the temples of the Yucatan. Larkin would go on to claim to have seen other temples on the mountainside as well, including ones in an apparent Greek style, with magnificent shining white marble columns. In addition to mentioning the opulent architecture, Larkin also claimed that the vicinity of the temples would often be beset by mysterious bright lights in the evening hours, and he claimed that the temples and lights were from the descendants of the Lemurian people. He said of these lights, "Their display of light far excels our modern electrical achievements, and I am, for one, consumed with curiosity to know how these people can produce such amazing light effects." A 1962 edition of the Australian Flying Saucer Review mentions in an article by Andrew Thomas the curious case of a forest fire in 1931, which ravaged much of the mountain, yet was kept from advancing by the appearance of a mysterious fog which halted the blaze in its tracks. In the aftermath of the fire, it was reportedly discovered that there was a perfectly clear and curved demarcation zone remaining between the charred earth and the undamaged areas. It was said by locals that this was the work of the Lemurians, protecting their domain through some unknown technological wizardry. Likewise, it is said that their city and structures are impervious to the effects of the many earthquakes that ravage the region. Sightings of these strange, tall Lemurians continue to this day. Typically, they are seen walking along roads or even city streets of towns on Mount Shasta, only to suddenly disappear, as if they were never there at all. This is all presumably due to their psychic abilities and uncanny expert knack for blending into their surroundings. Often, they are only glimpsed from the peripheral vision and elude any efforts to spy on them straight on. They are sometimes known to appear to help farmers who have fallen on hard times, using some sort of advanced agricultural techniques that revive the soil as if by magic. One account tells of a Lemurian woman who emerged from the forest in full view of a group of people and proceeded to lie down in the frigid water of Panther Springs for a full 5 minutes before silently getting back up and walking back into the wilderness from whence she came, all the while dripping wet from the freezing cold water. There are also numerous sightings of a strange boat, which is said to sail as far as the Aleutian Islands and will approach the shore, only to suddenly hover in the air and continue to make its way to Mount Shasta. Believe it or not, although Edward Lancer was unable to find the secret city, others have claimed they've been there. A Dr. M. DeReal claimed that he had penetrated into the mountain lair of the Lemurians and saw what he described as an enormous cavern that was an astounding 20 miles long, 15 miles wide, and 2 miles high, which was illuminated by a gigantic, blazing, artificial sun right in its center. Yet another account mentions a man who fell asleep on the mountain, only to be awakened by a Lemurian, who then brought him to a magnificent city paved with gold. Another finding of the underground city within Mount Shasta comes from a 1904 account, which first appeared in the 1934 edition of the Stockton Record, concerning a man named J.C. Brown, who was a British prospector who had come to the mountain with the Lord of Cowdray Mining to prospect for gold. During his expedition, Brown allegedly stumbled across a tunnel in the hillside, which led down into the darkness below the mountain. The prospector decided to venture into the opening and found that it stretched several miles into the murk and ended in a complex of rooms full of ornate statues, crystals, shields, and gold and copper plates. He also claimed to see an extravagantly decorated burial chamber containing at least 27 mummies that were described as being between 6'6 and 10 feet in height, several of which were wrapped in some sort of ornamental robes. The discovery was touted by Brown as being one of the most exciting archaeological finds of the century, and eventually an expedition led by John C. Root and comprised of 80 members was brought together to further explore the tunnel based on these claims. However, on June 19, 1934, the day of the exploration was set to set out from Stockton, California, J.C. Brown did not show up, and in fact, he was never seen again. It's a remarkable story, to be sure, but it seems highly suspicious since the find was made allegedly in 1904, yet the story was not made public until 1934. Most think that J.C. Brown's story was completely made up. Now, most of the stories of the Lemurians paints them as a benevolent race, helping struggling farmers and coming to the aid of lost travelers. But there are also stories that seem darker. One of the legends involves what are called Darrows, or short for degenerate robots, which were said to be Lemurian robots, which had gone insane and become malevolent machines bent on murder, mayhem, and destruction. These Darrows was popularized in a tale in the 1940s by Richard Shaver, who believed them to be the source of all of mankind's woes. As completely absurd as this may sound, there was an interesting story related to researcher and author and friend of the show David Politis about a young child who went missing while on a camping trip with his parents on the mountain in 2011. Now, the boy apparently suddenly disappeared without a trace and was not found for 5 hours, after which the shaken child came back with an extremely weird story to tell. According to the child, he had been abducted by an evil robot that had looked and sounded just like his grandmother. And he was taken to a huge underground cave populated by other human-looking robots as well as giant spiders. The real grandmother later claimed to have woken up face down on the ground in the forest, feeling violently ill, and found what appeared to be a small puncture wound on the back of her neck, presumably so that the robot could steal the genetic information it needed in order to duplicate her. Lemurians are not the only stories from around the Mount Shasta area. The area has long been a hot spot for Bigfoot activity as well. One of the most famous sightings was first reported in a 1976 edition of the Mount Shasta Herald. A man named Virgil Larson, 47, a logger working south of Cascade Gulch on the lower slopes of Mount Shasta, reported having an encounter with an enormous, hairy, and foul-smelling creature near a helicopter logging operation at about 8:30 a.m. Larson alleged that he had been with his partner, Pat Conway, in a pickup truck, which they parked at the top of the hill, before hiking down a steep slope. The two got separated, but could still hear each other, and this is when Larson claimed he had heard someone else approaching his position from the opposite direction, who he assumed at first to be someone from the Forest Service. When he could make out the shadow of who he thought was a man approaching, Larson called out to him, but whoever it was merely turned its head and kept walking, silently rounding a large bush about 20 yards away, almost as if to hide behind it. When the logger called out a second time, the figure reared up over the bush, and it became very clear that this was no human being. The creature was described as being covered with black, gnarled, matted hair, which was longer at the top of its head and seemed to be swept straight back from its eyebrows. Larson also mentioned that it had an overpowering stench, like a half-rotten bear hide. Terrified, Larson then ran off to tell his partner what he had seen. They returned to the area 30 minutes later, and it was reportedly still permeated by the odd, rotten stench. When they took a good look at the bush and held a hard hat up on a stick, they came to the estimation that the beast had to be around 7 to 7.5 feet tall. Bigfoot have been regularly sighted all over the mountain for years, but sightings of them are a little different than the normal version goes. For whatever reason, Bigfoot in this area have been described as materializing out of thin air and then vanishing just as suddenly as they came. They've also been seen levitating or passing through solid objects and even entering and exiting spacecraft. Another phenomenon of Mount Shasta is the intense UFO activity reported on the mountain. Dancing lights, mysterious flashes, orbs, metallic craft, glowing objects, luminous cigar-shaped objects, jellyfish-like craft, silent silver airships, and fleets of lights making amazing maneuvers have all been reported from here since long before electricity was even a thing. Some people have put forth the theory that these UFOs have some connection to the Lemurian civilization purported to live within the mountain, a claim somewhat supported by sightings of UFOs disappearing into the clouds that often shroud Mount Shasta's summit, or even right into the mountain itself. One interesting such sighting was made in 1956 by a resident named David Williamson, who observed a formation of 14 mysterious lights near the mountain for some time before one of the lights suddenly broke off and headed towards the mountain itself, descending straight down right onto the summit, where it vanished, presumably down some portal or opening. In addition to sightings of the Lemurians, Bigfoots or UFOs or little people, there have even been sightings of flying humanoids and giant birds. It seems nothing is too fantastic or too far-fetched when it comes to Mount Shasta. Are these all just crazy tales? Or is there something truly bizarre going on in Northern California? And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. I love these underground dwellers. You know, we've talked about, we've done episodes before on the inner earth. And that's kind of what this Mount Shasta stuff is with these Lemurians. You know, I do think it's odd, though, that the Native Americans of the area claim that these people are living there. And also, they talk about the history of those people. And those people are said to have come from another land that got taken over by the water.
Mm-hmm.
And they moved there.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's a really odd story for a few tribes in North America on the northwest coast of California to just make that story up. And it also happens to be that there actually was this island of Mu or Atlantis.
Yes.
So these Lemurians. I mean, it's awfully odd, don't you think?
Well, I think what it is I don't. I don't think it's odd now. I think when all this stuff first started coming out, it was odd then because I don't believe they knew then what we do now about the melting of the ice caps, the last ice age, how fast it all went down, all of these other things. A lot of this condemning of these ideas, I believe, happened way pre-90s. And pre-90s, of course, was before Robert Schock and John Anthony West was talking about the Sphinx, before Göbekli Tepe made it into the mainstream. You know, as you start seeing these things now, then you got to go back to the older stories like we've talked about. And then you got to go, okay, now that's what we have to look at. You know, we go back into that and be like, what these people are talking about, there is something to it now.
Yeah, once again, you know, racism plays a factor. They don't listen to the native people
exactly,
of that
yes.
area. They're like, these are, you know, these people don't know what they're talking about.
Yes.
Who knows if they did or didn't? All I'm saying is that it's funny that their stories and myths and legends go hand in hand with things that we know actually happened.
Yes.
Now, as far as like these Lemurians living underground with these awesome cities with a fake sun and UFOs that they're flying out of there, you know, some of that stuff, I don't know. Obviously, there was con men, that one guy that told everybody he knew where the city was and that they all met with him, that he was going to take them. And then, of course, he never showed up again.
Go ahead and pay me and I'll meet you there.
You know, con
I'll
men
bring
exist.
All the stuff.
And, of course, some of the stories are probably embellished. There could be a route there. Like we always talk about it. It's somewhere in the middle.
It's a little thread.
Something's going on there. I like all that. And then there's an awful lot of odd sightings, whether it's UFOs, whether it's Bigfoot, whether it's little people. There's all these bizarre things.
Well, that's what I like the most.
Happening around Mount Shasta.
It's like a hot spot.
Yeah.
I love that. But any of those. And what's funny is I always think of this. Is it a hot spot because it's truly a hot spot? Or is it a hot spot because it's people already think that's what's going to be there, you know, that they're already putting that on there? Because it always feels to me like it's a hot spot because something's going on. There's some nonsense taking place.
Yeah, well, some of the legends, like you say, in the local area, the ancients talk about there being portals and stuff in that area. Like we've talked about, where the layer between this world and the next is a little thinner for whatever reason. Could it be because of the volcanic, you know, activity in the area, you know, maybe plate tectonics, and somehow that's causing
something,
change in magnetism? And that's opening these portals. I don't know, but very cool stories.
It's funny you bring that up because I went to the movies today and with my wife and my daughter and saw Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. The Tim Burton show. And it was talking about time loops and little time slips is basically what the show is based upon, where they're hiding in a time loop or a time slip. And I never even thought of those angles until watching that movie. And then it starts making me think more about some of the stuff that you and I have covered. So it makes me completely rethink some of the stories that we've received and even covered after seeing that movie. It's a whole new idea on it.
I love that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it was great.
Speaking of those stuff, now, if you notice, there's been a change at the beginning of the show today.
That's right, folks. We have a sponsor.
We got a new sponsor, Gaia.com. That's G-A-I-A.com. And what this is a streaming service, and they have a lot of interesting documentaries over there, as well as shows and stuff. And they have a Seeking Truth area on their channel, and it's pretty interesting. I've watched several of these now. I watched one called UFOs and Nukes. And that was very interesting. I also watched this series of shows called Deep Space. There's one called like Inside the Program, The Covert Colonization of Space, Secrets of Anti-Gravity, and Dark Alliance, showing like we've talked about on the show where our government as well as other governments have signed these treaties with these extraterrestrials.
Yes.
And it's been working behind our backs all this time. Very interesting stuff. If you're a fan of like ancient aliens or anything like that, this is along those lines, except a little bit different, but and it has a lot of cool things. Mirage Men I saw is on there. Like we've mentioned, that was on Netflix.
Well, if you like this show, you're going to like this whole service because it covers the things like we all cover and then some. Kyle brought it up. I watched, of course, you know, we've talked to and are friends with Laird Scranton. He's got two shows on there. One of them's called Esoteric Science of the Dogon, and I've watched that one. And then there's another one called The Dogon, Egypt, and Buddhism. And that's another one that's with Laird. And it's there. And look, folks, we're not talking like 20 minutes here, stuff like that. There's hours longs of these shows that you can go in and dig into.
Over 7,000.
Yes, there's so much. And it's not just that, too. Like if you're into just getting healthy, there's yoga videos on there. There's all different sections. So it covers pretty much every walk of life. But like us, we're in the whole thing with the Seeking Truth. And you get in there, and there is so much stuff. The Ancient Origins, I could go on there and spend hours, man. It really is a lot of fun. It was great to actually now be able to go and see these things. Like we talked about, there's so much stuff about the Dead Sea Scrolls on it, stuff about the pyramids, stuff about the Anunnaki. And there's people, Michael Tellinger has stuff on there. David Wilcox has stuff on there. George Norrie is one of the guys that has movies and stuff on there. It's awesome.
Yeah, you should go check it out. It's GAIA.com, and I think you could sign up for as little as $7.95 a month.
If you pay it for the full year, it's like $95 and something, and you'll save a couple of bucks a month. But if not, if you sign up for the month, they'll give you your first month, I think, for 99 cents.
Yes.
And then after that, it's like $9.95 a month, and it's just, you know, the reoccurring stuff. So you can go try it out for a month or two. If you just want to do it for 2 or 3 months, I think they have a 3-month special, I believe, for like $20. So you shell out the 20 and go. I mean, it's one of those things that I never knew it existed until recently, and now I can't get enough of it.
That's pretty cool. Well, what do you got planned for your week?
Man, I do not know. I know my kids are all going out of town next week, this coming weekend, I mean, because they have like days off because of, you know, of course they celebrate Columbus Day.
Yeah.
Joke. But they're going to be doing stuff like that. So other than that, I don't know. You know, we all went out this weekend for my wife's birthday. My wife's birthday's Sunday. So we all went out and ate and drank and had a great time, had some fun.
You had a zombie Rita or something?
A zombie Rita, how was baby. That? Dude, those were so good. Had more than one. But yeah, those were really, really good. Had all organic agave. Like, I look like I'm an all organic kind of guy. But yeah, I was going off on the zombie Ritas. You were down there drinking some, what was it, whiskey and Coke you had on the end?
Crown and Seven, yeah.
Oh, yeah. He's working it over down there.
Dude, I had this shrimp dish that I've never had before there. And man, it was better than the main course. I was like, man, I'm just going to load up on that.
That's what I got. It was the shrimp brochet that they make there. Was that what it was with the bacon, the jalapenos, the cheese?
Yeah.
What it was is it's a Mexican food restaurant here, and I'm sure they're elsewhere too, but it's called Papacitos, and I'm sure most places have got them, but they have like Papa's Burgers and Papa Do's does the Cajun food, but this Mexican food restaurant is unbelievably good. For it to be some sort of chain, I believe. I think actually where the guy that started it all is out of Houston.
I think so.
I don't know how far it's actually, but it's, I say a chain, there's probably not a ton of them, but man, it is good. And I made the I always make the cardinal mistake when I go in there because I'm like, yeah, bring me a beer, and then I'll have these chips and hot sauce, and then go ahead and bring some tortillas while you're here too. And then it's just queso and hot sauce and chips and tortillas, and I'm like, by the time it's over, I'm like, I'm such a dumbass. Like, I knew I shouldn't have eaten all that, you know, because you're just going crazy, and they bring the main meal, and you're like, oh, man.
Oh, yeah, my plan was to go eat all that and then go back to the house and watch the UFC. I got back to the house. It was probably like 8:30. I sat in my lazy boy and I just sat there like a log. And I was like, you know, I think I'm going to go to bed.
I'm done. I think I'm done. I'm cooked. I'm done. It was me. I was going to come over there. Me and you were going to get together. Yeah. And I'm like, dude, I can't make it. I can't do this, dude.
It was like 10 o'clock and they started late, you know, 10 o'clock Central
Time. The main card,
yeah. I was like, Cam's not even here yet. Where the hell is he? And then I sent you a text. Are you like, are you coming over or what? And you were like, nah, I think I'm just going to stay in the house, bro.
I can't do it, man.
Like, I got you. No problem. You know, I was actually thinking the same thing. I was like, good, because I really don't want to stay up till 1 in the morning.
Exactly. I'm going to go lay down.
Awesome. Awesome. Now, I've got a baseball game, one this week, but besides that, just regular work. So everybody out there that's listening to this, please be careful out there. Don't work too hard. Give somebody a phone call. Tell them that you love them. Give somebody a hug. And for God's sake, stay out of trouble.
Yeah. I mean, come on, folks. It's not that hard.
Right? For all you elite members, we'll be speaking to you again on Thursday. For everyone else, we'll speak to you again the following Monday. Please be careful. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Much love from Texas, y'all. Peace.
Oh,